Ciao, and welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast, a dialogue about how space technology and exploration are transforming our solar system. Doug, welcome to the Frontier Space Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad you're here. How are things in California and JPL?
Well, the weather in Southern California is pretty nice. Have a lot of fires burning in Northern California, but we've had a very pleasant summer here in Southern California weather-wise. So that's good for this time of year.
Yep, those fires subside. So, but
us too.
Today's episode is on metallic glass, amorphous metals, and strain wave gears, and all sorts of exciting topics. Before we dive into your story, Doug, could you enlighten us? What are metallic glass or amorphous metals?
Sure. And as we get started, the standard boilerplate for me is that, you know, all the opinions I express today are my own and don't represent NASA or the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So amorphous metals, they're a class of metal alloys that are non-crystalline. So most metals that people are familiar with, all the atoms in there are arranged nicely in these perfect lattices. And the mechanical properties of those materials are dependent on the way those atoms are arranged in lattices. But there's class of materials, glasses, where the atoms are arranged randomly. And so the window pane glass that you see here, or, you know, your glass drink that you're drinking out of, all the atoms in those are arranged randomly. So there's a unique class of metal alloys where instead of all the atoms being arranged in a typical lattice, they're all, you know, arranged randomly like an oxide glass. And so you get what is an amorphous metal, also known as a metallic glass, which is, you know, effectively it is a glass that is made out of metal, except it's not transparent. So you would really not know that you're looking at an amorphous metal if you were holding one, but it's got properties that are really unique compared to crystalline metals because of the way all the atoms are arranged. So this is one of the many unique materials that we study at NASA to try to implement into spacecraft, satellites, and rovers for other planets to try to get a science advantage by using a material with unique properties.
Nice. And just reading a lot of the constituent elements are often the zirconium, titanium, and copper, and some others.
Yeah, you can make amorphous metals from a wide variety of alloy systems. Typically, you would find them in zirconium, titanium, copper, iron, nickel, but you can make them in refractory metals. You can make them in precious metals like platinum and palladium and gold. So there are a wide variety of amorphous metals, but the common ones that, you know, are kind of suitable for production of parts of substantial size are typically, you know, zirconium, copper, titanium, nickel, aluminum kind of alloys.
Nice. I'd love to hear more about your career, and you have such an inspiring and well-accomplished career.
So like, you know, many people, I started out my undergrad without a lot of clear direction about where I wanted to go. I was sort of drawn to engineering. I was good at math. So, you know, I went to UC San Diego and just enrolled in mechanical engineering degree because it seemed like the most versatile engineering degree, but I didn't really, you know, have a particular specialty that I was that interested in and so on. But during, you know, my time there and while I did my master's degree there, I started to work with some professors that were involved with material science and manufacturing. So I started doing some welding and some, development of new materials enabled through severe plastic deformation and so on. And I start to really learn to love materials manufacturing and mechanical testing. So when I completed my master's degree at UC San Diego, I was kind of considering, well, maybe I should go get a PhD in material science so that I can, you know, sort of specialize in this area of materials and manufacturing, basically metallurgy. And so at that time, which was around, you know, 2003, 2004, you know, metallurgy was not an extremely popular discipline. There were very few people doing it. It wasn't really at the cutting edge of, you know, of where science was happening at that time. There wasn't these huge labs doing metal 3D printing and stuff like that. So, you know, I selected a few groups around the world where they were doing really cool metallurgy work. And ultimately, I decided to come here to Southern California to the California Institute of Technology, Caltech. Of course, I knew of the proximity of Caltech to JPL. In fact, JPL is managed by Caltech as a federally funded research and development center. So I knew that there was close ties. And then my PhD advisor at Caltech, Bill Johnson, you know, was studying these amorphous metals, these metallic glasses, which had extremely strange properties. And he had lots of funding, particularly from NASA, to study these unique materials on the space shuttle and later on the space station. And there was just a lot of interest in uncovering, you know, what these materials were and what they could be used for. So I did my PhD in his group. And then I worked in industry for a year after my PhD. And then ultimately, I got hired at JPL to build a metallurgy facility there to try to bring some of the advanced materials and manufacturing research from Caltech over to JPL, with the idea that we should be focusing more on developing unique materials that can be used in spacecraft, satellites, and rovers, which is largely what JPL does. So there was a gap where there wasn't a research lab that was dedicated specifically to new materials for extreme environment spacecraft. So I proposed building a lab to do just that, had some significant support from management, and we found some other employees at JPL that had a background in material science that were willing to, you know, lead and start this effort, and off we went. And over the last 10 years, we've built a pretty substantial materials and manufacturing effort at JPL. We have a dedicated materials development group with 7 scientists in it, and we've got a dedicated additive manufacturing group, and, you know, maybe more than 20, 30 people around lab that work in this area, largely related to metal 3D printing. So it's been just a really wonderful ride, sort of being at the beginning of this effort to establish this new area of research and materials for JPL.
It's incredible. So you were pretty much like, you know, one of the founders of these centers at JPL. And I think, there's so much more during that time period that you accomplished. I feel like, you know, you published the 20 granted patents and 60 scientific papers. It's really impressive.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, I have a great team of scientists and engineers that I work with. It's really difficult to do metallurgy and manufacturing work on an island. So I was surrounded by, you know, really high quality scientists and engineers. And we also just happened to be working at the emergence of a new field, this field of, you know, renewed interest in metallurgy and in manufacturing sort of started happening around 2010. And we were, you know, one of the early groups working in that area. So there was a lot of discovery, a lot of, you know, intellectual property developed, a lot of papers that were published, a lot of collaborations, partnerships with, you know, NASA centers and the government and commercial industry. So it has been really a wonderful time these past, you know, 10 years plus.
Amazing. And so in 2014, you founded your first spinoff company, Amorphology, to commercialize the bulk metallic glass, the BMG gears and strain wave gears. And later you founded a second spinoff company focused on these amorphous metals and coatings and 3D printing and other areas. How does your research kind of tie into these initiatives behind the bulk metallic glass?
Well, I think, you know, I don't really, you know, want to talk about specific commercial companies, but overall, you know, starting a spinoff company yourself because you have enough intellectual property or your technology is so complicated that, you know, other large companies don't yet understand it. So sometimes you have to start small. So here at Caltech, where I'm actually at right now, you know, they're a world-class university. And so it's often common to, you know, to seed technology startup companies that start with a little kernel of an idea or some intellectual property, and then try to develop that into a commercial company that, you know, can go off and try to develop a product.
Nice. Became really interested in these strain wave gears, and I was wondering if you could speak more to them and how much potential they have for a lot of fields and industries.
Yeah, so the area of, you know, gears, it's a huge area and it's very complicated, and there's many different kinds of gearboxes, you know, from like planetary gearboxes to strain wave gears, depending on the kind of application that they're going to be in. So in a lot of applications that require high torque and low backlash, like in pick and place robots that you might find on like an auto assembly line, they use these large gears called strain wave gears, which are very bizarre gears if you've never seen them, but they have very, you know, nice properties in that they have a very high reduction ratio and high torque, and they don't have backlash in them. They're able to basically hold their position without shaking. So if you're thinking about making like a humanoid robot that has a long arm on it, you think about the way your shoulder works with all the tendons and bones and muscles that lift your arm up because it's a giant lever. But if I'm going to make myself a robot, it's pretty difficult to design all the tendons and muscles to be able to make my arm move. But I could put a large, high torque strain wave gear in that arm and be able to completely lift my arm around. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting gearboxes that are used in space, and we use a lot of them on things like our rovers, like the Mars rovers. We've had now several classes of Mars rovers, you know, Curiosity and Opportunity and Spirit and Sojourner, Perseverance. And those rovers have wheels, and they have robotic arms that move to do drilling and to take pictures, and all of those use gearboxes. And there's lots of issues with running gearboxes in space. In particular, space is cold, and so you have to be able to you know, run a gearbox that can operate in cold vacuum environments typically. And the conventional way we make gears on Earth is with steel. And you lubricate the steel with liquid lubricants, and then you have your gearbox. So almost every gearbox that you see today, from, you know, gearbox in a robot to a gearbox in a car, it's lubricated with oil or other types of liquid lubricants. And if you go to space or somewhere really cold, those lubricants freeze and then your gearbox doesn't run. So you have to start thinking about dry lubricants, you know, lubricant or unlubricated gears, like thinking about using a ceramic for your gearbox. But of course, then you're afraid that your gearbox is going to be brittle and it'll break when you land, like violently land on the surface of Mars. So there's some opportunity in space to be able to use gearboxes of different kinds that can run cold and without liquid lubricant. And from some of our early experiments on Bolt metallic glass, also known as amorphous metals, they have very nice combination of properties for being created into gears, particularly these strain wave gears, which are difficult to manufacture. So overall, the benefit of using these materials in space-like gearboxes is that they can operate cold without conventional liquid lubricants on them. And that is a big advantage, considering most of the gearboxes that we run in space don't have to run to very long life, like you would see in a car gearbox, for example. So you may be running the gearbox to open solar panels or to move a robotic arm to do drilling or even to drive. And so there's a really emerging application for these new gearboxes in space. And now with dozens of space startup companies and established space companies starting to put more robotic systems into space that require gearboxes to move them, there's this now really unique opportunity to use metallic glasses as those gearboxes.
Wonderful. And so I was also reading they you don't need a heat source to operate the BMG gears, and that you could potentially these high precision gears, they cut the costs of the robotic arms by at least 50%.
Yeah, so about what you said there, the heating, first off. So if you're going to use a gearbox like on a Mars rover that uses conventional liquid lubricants, if it's colder than the freezing point of those lubricants, or you're in space and it's very cold, you have to heat the gearbox up to be able to make the lubricant liquid, and then run the gearbox while it's hot. And so you usually will have to supply power to heat the gearbox. And space power is extremely precious resource, whether it's from your nuclear battery on your Mars rover, or it's from the solar panels that you have on your satellite. Power is a precious resource. So using it to heat gearboxes so that they can operate is a frustrating part of running gearboxes in space, especially if those gearboxes could run perfectly well without the need for the lubricant. So that's a benefit of using unlubricated or dry lubricated gears in space. About the manufacturing, that's kind of a different angle about amorphous metals, is that unlike other materials, they can be cast or injection molded or blow molded even because of the unique properties of them being amorphous. So you can die cast them like plastics, you can injection mold them, and you can form them thermoplastically even. So the manufacturing of the gears can be much more similar to plastics. And that doesn't mean that we wouldn't conventionally machine the amorphous metals into gears. It just means that there are other ways that you can manufacture complex parts out of them. And particularly those strain wave gears that we were talking about have one very large cup-like component called a flex spline, which is a very thin-walled cup with gear teeth on it. And that is a very difficult part to machine. So with advanced casting or blow molding or thermoplastic forming, those those gearboxes become a potentially lower cost to manufacture. So, you know, for there, it's kind of two sides of the issue. One is, you know, high performance in space so that you have the best possible solution if you're going to run a gearbox and make a robot in space. And then the other one is the lower cost manufacturing, which has benefits for, you know, the commercial world, companies trying to make satellites that have robotic arms on them or gearboxes on them. It would benefit them if the gearboxes could be cheaper. So both of those things are possible with amorphous metals.
Awesome. Yeah, gee whiz, that was reading that NASA's Curiosity rover, it spends around 3 hours heating up the lubricants for gears each day and using about a quarter of the energy that day. So it sounds like, you know, some major implications for a lot of the research that you helped pioneer.
Yeah, and that's a good example. Both Curiosity and Perseverance use conventional steel gearboxes with liquid lubricant. But in particular, you'll notice that we flew the Ingenuity helicopter. So in the future, we might be interested in flying a lot more helicopters or quadcopters on Mars to do further science. And so now you've got another opportunity where there might be a lot of gearboxes. And those gearboxes that go in a helicopter have to be very small, compact, lightweight. So now by getting rid of the need to heat them and cartridge heat them and associated cabling to run heaters, now you have a potential big advantage for helicopters. So that's like a future infusion point, which would be ideal for these materials. But in particular, you're thinking about space. A lot of these small spacecraft that are being launched, it's really advantageous to put robotic arms on them for all sorts of reasons, to position antennas and to, you know, open solar panels and to do in-space 3D printing if you want to. So running gearboxes in space will ultimately require that, you know, you manage the heat, and being able to run gearboxes that don't need heating is a huge advantage.
Love it. Yeah, I was skimming through your highly cited PhD thesis you published in 2009, and you mentioned this titanium vanadium based glass dendrite composite system looked like part of the core of your concept.
Yeah, so that area is sort of a distinct area in amorphous metals, and that's the area of amorphous metal composites or BMG composites. And one of the issues with amorphous metals as they are is that they don't exhibit a lot of ductility or very high fracture toughness. So when you use them in engineering applications, they tend to fail in a brittle manner, which doesn't mean you can't design things like gearboxes around that property. But for many applications, you need a higher level of strength and toughness to survive. So mostly what I worked on my PhD is taking metallic glasses and making composites out of them, where the metallic glass is reinforced with soft crystal phases that imparts substantial amounts of toughness and ductility into them. So then you have a class of amorphous metals that have still a high strength, but can be bent and have much higher fracture toughness. Now, when you do that, you're mixing this, you know, hard amorphous phase with a soft phase. So some properties like wear resistance goes down a lot. So those alloys aren't particularly useful for gears, but they are useful for lots of other applications that would benefit amorphous metals in space, like flexures and mechanisms, where you need to, you know, bend apart without it breaking, without using gears. And that's an application where amorphous metals are wonderful at. Of course, there were lots of potential commercial applications for those tougher metallic glasses and things like golf clubs and and so on, where you really want that high strength, but the high fatigue limit and the high fracture toughness. So it's kind of a distinct class of alloys within amorphous metals that has its own unique applications. So it sort of just broadens where you can use amorphous metal technology. So instead of having applications where you just can't use an amorphous metal because the properties aren't right, you can tailor the alloys into these composites to satisfy new applications. And that's kind of an exciting part about materials development, the ability to change the properties of your alloys to make them suitable for different applications.
Yeah, I'm really excited about, you know, coatings these days, and think that we can, you know, design and tailor systems and materials to you know, accomplish any sort of performance with the right coatings. And so how could we apply these glass metals and alloy composites into the coating side?
Yeah, you know, the idea of the amorphous metal coatings, you know, that has existed for many decades. In particular, there were some iron chromium based alloys that were commercialized, you know, in the 1970s and 80s and are still used today, which are thermally sprayed onto steel for hard facing, hard banding, that kind of thing. A lot of applications in the oil and gas industry where you want just a really hard, wear resistant surface that is applied to something that's going to be in an abrasive environment. The kinds of coatings that I was really thinking about was basically, I was thinking about, well, the properties of amorphous metals in a lot of applications that I really like are the smooth finish, the hardness, the very high hardness, the wear resistance, the corrosion resistance that is native of these amorphous materials, the high coefficient of restitution, which gives you this very high bouncing property off the surface. There were a lot of benefits of amorphous metal that that you might want to impart on the surface of something, like a golf club, for example, or on my cell phone, or on my watch. And there's a lot of materials in our everyday life that are in abrasive environments or corrosive environments. So I got to thinking about like trying to take these amorphous metals and instead of casting the entire part out of amorphous metal, like making your entire watch out of it, instead just apply enough of the metallic glass to the surface of something cheaper and more tough, but take the advantage of the metallic glass and just get it on the surface. So that was the objective. How do you do that? The reasons that we're interested in that kind of technology for NASA is in particular going back to the moon, for example. We have to contend with this very horrible regolith. And this regolith on the moon is very fine powder of basically basalt rock. And it gets everywhere. And it's very small. And, you know, through static charge, it sticks to kind of everything. And then if you have any moving parts, you've got this really abrasive surface. So we're looking at smooth materials that are abrasion resistant. And so that's where these amorphous metal coatings look like they could have a lot of potential advantages. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out new ways to apply these amorphous metal coatings to metal substrates. So, you know, a lot of the work that we did early on in that area was basically inventing machines that would take these amorphous metals, melt them, apply them to a surface in a way that would, you know, impart the amorphous metal properties to the surface when cooled down. So that is an area that we, you know, have demonstrated and commercial industry is working on. And it just looks like an extremely promising area. So I suspect, you know, in the future, there will be a lot of technologies developed in the commercial industry world related to amorphous metal coatings.
I look at Really excited just, you know, listening to you and just this entire topic. And imagine there's all sorts of, you know, applications for where gearbox are used, you know, airplanes, automotive parts. And was reading they're also biocompatible and used for the medical device implants and it's amazing.
Yeah. So that's, you know, where those are, you know, kind of like the commercial targets for, you know, where these materials sort of fit. Of course, we're, you know, really interested in them for spacecraft, and they appear to be one of the best solutions for making gears work in spacecraft and on rovers. But of course, there are a lot of commercial applications for robotics in particular that are growing. So there's this, you know, big trend now in automation and artificial intelligence and advanced robotics, where they're just trying to decrease the cost and increase the performance of robots. And I know, you know, when we were kids, they always told us that we'd have robot helpers and there'd be robots in our day-to-day lives. And a lot of that has been hindered by the cost of these robots. A lot of that is in the cost of the gear. And then, like you mentioned, in medical devices and in even in things like food service industry, where you don't want liquid lubricant like dripping into food as robots are making food, or you don't want lubricant dripping into someone's body as your surgery robot is working on them. There are lots of places where gearboxes that don't require lubricant have a future in the commercial world, separate from the spacecraft world. So that's, you know, part of the great synergy about NASA developing technology and then pushing it off to commercial industry to go run with it. You know, that's you know, we have a long-standing history at NASA of doing just that, identifying an area in space where something new is needed, and then finding out that, wow, that thing has a lot of benefits to people living on Earth. And you've seen this a lot with, you know, like sensors, for example, sensors that we use to look at different planets or to, you know, to measure climate change. Those sensors can be put into drones and flown around and do all sorts of cool measurements from here on the ground using that same technology that started at NASA.
Incredible. For the strain wave gears, I was looking at some images and for the inner spline teeth, I was wondering if there's some kind of coatings that we could apply between the two extra kind of teeth.
Yeah, that's, you know, that is a totally reasonable thing that you just said. So that flex spline that becomes part of the strain wave gear, you know, that part can be cast or blow molded out of metallic glass, both of which have been demonstrated. It's been machined, so you could make that whole part out of, you know, a new amorphous material. You could also think about taking a conventional steel part and coating those teeth with amorphous metal, which is something that's also really interesting. And one of the things we've been looking at more recently is 3D printing that entire part, and let alone 3D printing the part as a net shape. We've actually been looking at 3D printing the part while changing the composition so that the teeth on that part have a different composition than the rest of the part, to put higher wear resistance in the teeth, but use a more fatigue resistant alloy in the rest of the gearbox. So that is where, you know, the additive manufacturing, the 3D printing, has added a whole new wrinkle to this area of materials. When you can now, you know, 3D print complex parts that were previously machined, and you can 3D print them with new materials, and then you can even coat those parts with amorphous materials or with other materials, and create, you know, technology on top of technology to be able to get ultimately low cost, high performance gears. So I really believe that innovations in these areas have a very direct line towards real changes in our day-to-day life, if you can make robots cheaper and more accessible, that is really the next thing that will fundamentally change our lives. I know our cell phones have fundamentally changed all of our lives. You know, that is a clear case where, you know, before the cell phone, the smartphone revolution, the way we interacted with devices was completely different. And the way we interacted with people in our world was completely different. I think a lot of people know that the next big change that comes where people are change the way that they interact is with robots that work in tandem.
Yeah, it's quite profound. You know, how many of the robotic systems on the moon and Mars and do you think will have these strain wave gears but then also the amorphous metals?
All right, that's a good question. So right now, you know, all of the gearboxes on Mars, they're all conventional gearboxes. I can't speak for the other countries that have rovers on the surface, like China has a rover on the surface. I don't know what theirs are made of. But certainly all the ones that NASA has made, they're, you know, all conventional gearboxes. So of those gearboxes, though, they, you know, some of them are strain wave gearboxes and some of them are planetary gearboxes. Typically in drive systems on wheels, you want planetary gearboxes with a sun gear and planets that go around it. And those are typically good for long life, low torque applications like driving wheels. And then the strain wave gears are really good for the robotic arms and so on. Almost all of those have strain wave gears in them. Curiously, the first, the lunar buggies that were made during the Apollo days that we all remember, the astronauts driving on the surface, the lunar surface in those buggies, those were actually powered by strain wave gears. One of the first big time applications of strain wave gears. So those were drive systems that had strain wave gears in them. So I think in the future, if we're thinking about the lunar exploration, I think it'll be a combination of planetary gears and strain wave gears, depending on the type of rover or lander. Does it have a robotic arm? Is it driving? Does it need high torque to like dig and excavate? So it's going to be a mix of both. And we're very excited about the prospects of getting gearboxes, metallic glass gearboxes, amorphous metals on some of these robotic arms. So we're working diligently with some commercial companies to see that come to pass. So some strain wave gears and planetary gears into a robotic arm digging on the surface of the moon, we hope is our first infusion of the technology. And so hopefully we're looking at as early as, you know, 2022 or 2023, being able to demonstrate that technology. But certainly we expect to see these materials being competitive in space, you know, space-based robotics and satellites for all gear systems.
Excellent. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the shape memory alloys integrated into strain wave gears and if there's some synergy there.
Yeah, I think that would also be interesting as well. Of course, with the shape memory alloys like nitinol, for example, they are difficult to manufacture, just like steel is. So if you're going to make these kind of strain wave gears out of shape memory alloys, you would have to manufacture them in the same kind of laborious process that's used to make steel. And the wear resistance of those alloys is not going to be as good as steel. So they don't have the optimal combination of, you know, strength, manufacturability, and wear resistance that steel and amorphous metals have. So I think there's certainly a lot of applications for shape memory alloys. They're a very underutilized material, just like amorphous metals in spacecraft, but you have a lot of people that are working, including scientists in the group I work in, that are diligently working on new applications for shape memory alloys as well. And we also have scientists in the group I'm in that are working in other you know, really exciting and underutilized areas like 3D printed lattices for spacecraft, and then really advanced heat exchangers that are 3D printed for spacecraft, and then multi-material magnetic materials that go in thrusters that, you know, enable future spacecraft. So all the scientists in the group that I'm in, they're all working on advanced materials and manufacturing, just like I have been working on amorphous metals, to try to bring some of the benefits of these really novel materials, coupled with really advanced manufacturing that has emerged over the last 10 years to do things in space that have previously not been possible.
Awesome. Yeah, I was looking over some of your other publications, and looks like a lot of opportunity with thermal spray additive manufacturing and the ultrasonic welding.
Yeah, those are both exciting and emerging technologies. So thermal spraying and also the similar technology of cold spraying, it's, you know, typically been used as a coating process where you just spray either molten metal or hypersonic metal and get it to stick to a substrate and can build up nice coatings. But more recently, that technology has been used to actually do like bimetallic 3D printing, where you're making materials that have more than one composition. And that's, you know, a really exciting area, especially because thermal spraying and cold spraying allows you to use alloys like amorphous metals that were previously inaccessible in those kind of applications. So one of the really neat things you can do with thermal spray additive manufacturing, for example, is build up like a really large iron-based metallic glass part that can then be used in like electric motors and stuff like that. So that's a really exciting use of that technology. Ultrasonic additive manufacturing, that's a new and exciting 3D printing technology that basically welds metal ribbons together to produce a net shape that can be one material or many materials together. And that technology has shown a lot of promise for NASA for making things like large antennas and cold plates that have integrated cooling in them. These technologies that are emerging for manufacturing, they offer something typically that is new, something that has never been possible before. So when one of those new additive manufacturing technologies comes around, and all of a sudden you can produce a part that you have been struggling to make in the past, that's where it's really enabling. So you've got ultrasonic additive manufacturing comes along, and now you can make a giant 2-meter aluminum part that has integrated cooling in it. Well, dang, that's been a really difficult kind of part to manufacture conventionally with machining or with investment casting. So now we've got something new that we can use in spacecraft.
Mind is blown. It's a lot to process. A lot of really exciting things. We'll have to read more up on. Also really interested in the kind of the, you know, the organic side of things and of this concept, and if there could be some applications on the bioengineering side and really enabling, you know, biological cells to operate, you know, gears without lubricants.
That's obviously, you know, the bioengineering angle is an angle we don't work a ton on, at least in our group. We're mostly focused on robotic space exploration, but yeah, the bioengineering world is, they're really pioneering a lot of really cool applications for materials and manufacturing. I've just been blown away following, you know, the progress and the work on, you know, 3D printing, you know, biological cells or materials that are compatible with biology, and, getting materials and biology to integrate together, like bone growth through 3D printed materials. So that area is just really exciting to me to follow, even if I don't have a lot of contributions for that area.
Yes, yes, indeed. Curious if we could adapt these strain rate gears for, you know, from the millimeter scale down to the, you know, microns and the nanometer side as well, for to fabricate, nanofabricate these gears.
Well, I mean, that would be awesome. Obviously, the big issue is when you scale things down, you're scaling down the length scale of all your parts. So the length scale of my strain wave gear now is like 2 inches sort of size, 50 millimeters. Now, if I scale that length down to 5 millimeters, the frictional forces that come into play with gears, they don't scale linearly with length. So frictional forces start to dominate when you make things that are small. So it starts making small gears more difficult. However, with the amorphous metals, there have been really great demonstrations of MEMS gears, very, very small gears that are micro fabricated. And so this is one of those technologies where, yeah, the gearboxes do work when they're very small, but you have to completely redesign them to accommodate the higher frictional forces that are involved at those length scales. So yeah, a lot of people are interested in working on those. So I'd be excited to see the kinds of applications for small devices powered by micro gears.
Yes, yes. And you're really an inventor and you know, pioneer in this field. It really sounds like so. You know, love a lot of the work you're doing and keep up the great research and effort.
Well, yeah, thanks for hosting me on this podcast. And as always, I just like to, you know, thank, you know, JPL and the huge group of scientists, engineers, and all of our, you know, commercial partners and industry partners and government partners. Like I said, you know, this is really a team effort. So there's no, you know, one person that's pioneering all of this. We're only successful because we're working together in a big team. So this is really a really great joint effort, and I'm excited that I was able to come and talk to you about it. So thanks for having me.
Anytime. Look forward to next time and cross some paths sometime. So take care.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Appreciate it.